The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. President Joe Biden and his wife, Dr. Jill Biden. Like the Obamas, the Bidens have a decades-long relationship that's allowed them to power through and withstand the pressures of Washington and their own personal tragedy. And when you hear their story, it won't be too difficult to understand their connection. In 1972, Biden lost his first wife and college sweetheart, Nelia, and one-year-old daughter, Naomi, in a car accident, leaving him to raise their two sons, Beau and Hunter, alone. But 3 years later, he found Jill, née Jacobs, then a co-ed at the University of Delaware. "She gave me back my life," Biden said in his 2007 memoir, Promises to Keep. "She made me start to think my family might be whole again." Indeed, Jill is protector-in-chief when it comes to Joe, especially as he hit the campaign trail in 2020. When protesters disrupted a victory speech Biden was delivering on Super Tuesday, the now First Lady was deemed a hero for fending off the woman who lunged on stage. Video of the confrontation went viral on social media, but the scuffle to protect her husband did not faze Jill Biden one bit, who tweeted after the speech was over, "What a night." Plus, there's another role that she's equally serious about, teacher-in-chief. Not only is Jill a vocal advocate for teachers and educators nationwide, but she has also always maintained that she would continue teaching during her husband's presidency, making her the first First Lady to hold a full-time job outside of the East Wing. In September 2020, after spending a year teaching remotely, the longtime educator returned to in-person classes at Northern Virginia Community College, where she teaches writing. "There are some things you just can't replace, and I can't wait to get back in the classroom," she told Good Housekeeping. Ahead, everything you need to know about Dr. Jill Biden. During his first speech as president-elect, Joe gave a shout-out to all educators listening. "You'll have one of your own in the White House with the First Lady. Jill has been teaching for 3 decades. Jill's a mom, a military mom, and an educator. She's dedicated her life to education, but teaching isn't just what she does, it's who she is," Joe continued. In the late 70s, during the early years of her relationship with Joe, Jill began her 30-plus year career in education. She's taught writing in high school and community colleges and went on to earn 2 master's degrees and a doctorate in education from the University of Delaware in 2007. Despite a brief hiatus while her husband was on the campaign trail, according to CNBC, it was the first time she took a break since 1981, she has continued to maintain a job teaching writing and English at Northern Virginia Community College for over a decade, according to the Washington Post. And from the early days of the campaign, the veteran educator made it clear that the title of First Lady of the United States wouldn't halt her career. In an interview with CBS, Jill said, "If we get to the White House, I'm going to continue to teach. I want people to value teachers and know their contributions and to lift up the profession." To drive that point home, during the 2020 DNC, she issued a speech from her former Delaware classroom where she taught high school in the 90s. "Joe's purpose has always driven him forward," she said. "His strength of will is unstoppable, and his faith is unshakable, because it's not in politicians or political parties or even in himself. It's in the providence of God. His faith is in you, in us." She's held up her promise since moving to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. After spending her first semester as FLOTUS teaching remotely, Jill, or as her students call her, Dr. B, returned to teaching in person at Northern Virginia Community College. That makes her the first First Lady to leave the White House and log hours at a full-time job. She was also the first Second Lady to do so. "There are some things you just can't replace, and I can't wait to get back in the classroom," she told Good Housekeeping, adding, "Working with community college students is deeply rewarding. My students work incredibly hard to make it to class, often between work and raising families. They want to learn. They bring diverse perspectives to our studies of travels and jobs and families and challenges they've had to overcome. It is such an honor to be the person to walk them through their studies, to give them the key that could unlock something life-changing." Joe and Jill Biden went to the movies on their first date. In 1975, according to Vogue, the two were introduced by Joe's brother. At the time of their first date, he was a Delaware senator with 2 children and 9 years Jill's senior. She was in her last year at college at the University of Delaware. According to the magazine, the two went to the theater, saw the movie A Man and a Woman, and as they say, the rest was history. But at first, the couple kept up with the illusion that their relationship was just fun. She was just starting her own career, Biden wrote in Promises to Keep. I think it was easier for her in the beginning of our courtship when I wasn't thinking about marriage. We both just liked having fun with somebody again, and she wanted to keep it that way. Joe's sons urged him to marry Jill. In Promises to Keep, Biden explained that while he didn't introduce his then new girlfriend to Beau and Hunter right away, once he did, they hit it off and Jill was around for all major holidays, including Thanksgiving and Christmas. In fact, the boys were the first ones to suggest marriage. At the ages of 7 and 6, respectively, Beau and Hunter brought up the subject to their father while he was shaving one morning. Joe recalled the moment in a book passage featured in the Washington Post. Finally, Hunter spoke up. Beau thinks we should get married. What do you mean, guys? Beau? Well, Beau said, we think we should marry Jill. What do you think, Dad? I think that's a pretty good idea, I told them. I'll never forget how good I felt at that moment. Joe proposed to Jill Biden several times before they got engaged. It was revealed to Vogue that President Biden had to propose to his future wife 5 times before she said yes, but there was no ill will on Jill's part. She had Beau and Hunter in mind when making her decision. By that time, of course, I had fallen in love with the boys, and I really felt that this marriage had to work, she told the magazine, because they had lost their mom, and I couldn't have them lose another mother, so I had to be 100% sure. Of course, she eventually said yes, and the couple were married on June 17, 1977. Joe and Jill Biden had an intimate wedding. In his book, Biden explained they were wed at the United Nations Chapel in New York City with only family in attendance, which totaled just under 40 people. Beau and Hunter accompanied them at the altar because it was their union, too. The way they thought of it, the four of us were getting married, he wrote. Yes, we're crying, too. The family was complete in June 1981 when they welcomed a daughter. Her brothers got to choose her name, Ashley. Over the years, Joe has given Jill corsages to mark special occasions. Photographers on Inauguration Day spotted a stunning white corsage on Dr. Biden's wrist while the pair watched the celebratory fireworks show in the evening. According to their interview with People, President Biden has been giving her corsages for decades now, and it's become a romantic tradition of theirs. I love gardenias, and so Joe would buy me a wrist corsage of gardenias. I think it was for Valentine's Day the first time, Dr. Biden said. I wore it to school to teach. It's just a tradition, and he surprised me with it. They're still making time for romance during Joe's presidential term. The Bidens have never exactly had oodles of free time, but their schedules are particularly jam-packed with Joe's POTUS tenure and Jill juggling her first lady and teaching responsibilities. Dr. Biden appeared on the Kelly Clarkson show and talked about their adjustment to life in the White House. One thing she stressed is that despite their intense commitments, they make time each night to sit with each other for dinner away from their phones. He's so busy, I'm so busy, but we do keep dinner. We have dinner together, no phones, the phones have to be off. And now we're having dinner in this beautiful home. There's a fireplace in the dining room that they light, she said. We just sit and talk for a while. And then he has to go back to work into the night, and I'm grading papers. Dr. Biden also revealed that they've done their best to keep up a family tradition of getting together with their children and grandchildren for weekly Sunday night meals. They seem to have shut down their joint foundation. Together, Joe and Jill co-chaired the Biden Foundation, a nonprofit that sought to support causes close to the couple's hearts. Military families, advancement in community colleges, support for LGBTQ equality, and much more. However, the New York Times reported that when Joe announced his 2020 candidacy, they suspended the charity in efforts to remain financially transparent throughout the campaign. The foundation, which was created after he left office in 2017, raised $6.6 million in its inaugural year. The Times wrote that following the suspension of activities, the Biden Foundation would begin a longer process of gradually dismantling itself. It does not appear that the foundation has been active in any way since April 2019. The Bidens have been married for over 40 years and have overcome tragedy. Biden served in the U.S. Senate until 2009 when he was selected as Barack Obama's vice president. He held a position for two terms until 2017. Jill went on to earn two master's degrees and doctorate in education at the University of Delaware. But in 2015, their family suffered unimaginable heartache after Beau, who served as Delaware's attorney general, died of brain cancer at age 46. This affected Biden's choice to not run for president in 2016, a race he was then favored to enter. Both Joe and Jill chose to open up about Beau's illness through literature. For Biden, it was his candid 2017 memoir, Promise Me, Dad, A Year of Hope, Hardship, and Purpose. Jill's, Where the Light Enters, came out in 2019. I'm thrilled to tell a story that is such an enormous part of my heart, the story of how we built and rebuilt our family, she told People magazine. In their interview with People, the Bidens spoke candidly about how they have supported each other through adversity and loss during their decades of marriage. She has a backbone like a ramrod. Everybody says marriage is 50-50. Well, sometimes you have to be 70-30, President Biden said. Thank God that when I'm really down, she steps in, and when she's really down, I'm able to step up. We've been really supportive of one another. Dr. Biden also weighed in, talking about how their struggles have helped strengthen their bond. All that we've been through together, the highs, the lows, and certainly tragedy and loss, there's that quote that says, sometimes you become stronger in the fractured places. That's what we try to achieve. When asked whether they've been relying on prayer to help them get through the unprecedented stress of the pandemic, President Biden revealed that Dr. Biden actually tapes notes with important messages she wants Joe to understand to his mirror. Jill, when she wants me to get a real message, she tapes it up on the mirror above the sink where I shave. And she put up a great quote from Kierkegaard saying, faith sees best in the dark, he explained. She's written three books, including one about her husband. One of the best ways to get to know Jill Biden is via her writing. Jill has published two children's books, including one about her husband, Joey, The Story of Joe Biden. It's peppered with never-before-heard anecdotes about Joe's childhood in Scranton and the formative years that laid the groundwork for his career in politics. Her second book, Don't Forget, God Bless Our Troops, was inspired by her granddaughter, Natalie, whose father was serving in the armed forces and broaches the reality of having a parent at war. Older audiences will enjoy Jill's 2019 memoir, Where the Light Enters, Building a Family, Discovering Myself. Growing up, Jill had wanted two things, a marriage like her parents, strong, loving, and full of laughter, and a career. An early heartbreak had left her uncertain about love until she met Joe. But as they grew closer, Jill faced difficult questions. How would politics shape her family and professional life? And was she ready to become a mother to Joe's two young sons, reads the publisher's description. Essentially, it covers some topics in this article, but filtered through Jill's own words. Our next article by Wadzani Moot is titled, The Well-Read Black Girl is Starting a Podcast and Building a Legacy. When you first meet Glory Edom, several words spring to mind. Bubbly and warm are just a few. She speaks easily about her love of books and lists authors, dead and alive, who have shaped her life. But to know Edom is to realize that she is a formidable entrepreneur, a voracious reader, and a legacy builder. Edom never dreamed of having the kind of literary influence she now wields when she was growing up in Arlington, Virginia, where a love of books was nurtured by her mother. What started as a pastime became essential to understanding her place in the world while attending college at Howard University. There, she picked up Audre Lorde, bell hooks, and Toni Morrison, seeing herself on the page and finding comfort in their words. In 2015, Edom's partner gifted her a t-shirt printed with the words, Well-Read Black Girl, which have since inspired a movement. She became the face of the Well-Read Black Girl Book Club in Brooklyn, a community for Black women to come together around beloved classics and newly discovered reads. In 2017, Edom established the annual Well-Read Black Girl Festival. In 2018, she published Well-Read Black Girl, Finding Our Stories, Discovering Ourselves, a collection of essays from Black writers. Her second book, published in 2021, On Girlhood, 15 Stories from the Well-Read Black Girl Library, is an anthology divided into four themes, innocence, belonging, love, and self-discovery, with short stories from Jamaica Kincaid, Alice Walker, and Toni Morrison, among others. She has a memoir titled Gather Me, which will be published this month. What started as a group of about 10 people has now blossomed to over 400,000 on Instagram and partner book clubs nationwide. President Barack Obama joined the online book club in 2021 to discuss A Promised Land. This growth has aligned with the book club's mission. Our aim is to amplify the voices of Black writers and celebrate their achievements in the literary world. Edom has teamed up with LiveWrite Publishing Corporation, a subsidiary of W.W. Norton & Company, to publish a series of debut fiction titles. WRBG times LiveWrite is launching in 2023 and will feature women and non-binary authors with a focus on people of color and traditionally underrepresented voices. Now Edom has a new podcast from Pushkin Industries, Well-Read Black Girl with Glory Edom, which began airing fittingly on the first day of Black History Month. On it, she plans to feature authors and other creatives. We talked to Edom about her new podcast and what lies ahead for the inspiring curator who seems to be able to do it all. Note, this interview has been edited for clarity. Oprah Daily, you have had a successful book club and two books, Well-Read Black Girl and On Girlhood. How do you have time, and can you talk about your latest book? Edom, I've been learning a lot, and I've just been trying to slow down, to rest, and be gentle with myself. I don't even know how I was even able to complete On Girlhood. I finished it right before my son was born, and it launched in October last year. On Girlhood was a beautiful project for me. I love short stories because of the brevity and the skill required. After the first book, I really wanted to meditate and think about what my own girlhood meant to me and the stories I read that really helped shape my identity. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of coming-of-age stories for young Black girls, and the ones published tend to be really sad. I wanted to find a collection of stories that really meditated on joy and happiness and were intergenerational, showing the variety of our experiences. Why did you start the podcast? It was the next step in the Well-Read Black Girl community. I was getting so many incredible inquiries from members about what's next. I knew in my gut that I wanted to be having more conversations with authors. In the book club, we talk about the books and their characters, but we also discuss work, relationships, and our lives in general. I wanted to reflect that on the podcast, where we could talk to writers and get more in-depth about their process and look at how they became the people they are. It has been amazing also to watch the progression of their careers. I witnessed so many writers share their first book when the book club began, and now some of them have 2-3 books, and their success is continuing to grow. I think of Britt Bennett and reading her first book, The Mothers, a beautiful coming-of-age story. Now her second book is out, The Vanishing Half, and it too is just phenomenal. She is going to continue to be this incredible voice of our community, our generation. I'm just honored to have been a very small part of her origin story. Seeing how the writers have transformed, I wanted to take that transformation and share it in the podcast so we could hear more of their stories. It's also part of legacy building. It's one thing to have these conversations amongst ourselves, but it's another to hear them recorded and saved in the space where generations can listen again and again. That's definitely my goal. What do you hope the reach of your podcast will be? I want it to be a tool for others to bravely tell their stories to a global audience. I've had the privilege to be one-on-one with these powerful women writers, and their voices should be widely shared, widely heard. The internet has made the world a little smaller and allows us to connect in new ways, so I hope this podcast allows folks, wherever they live, whether Brooklyn, South Africa, Berlin, or Nigeria, to feel that sense of community. In a lot of ways, I also wanted to shake up the status quo, to reimagine the literary canon. They can, instead of reaching for the white male classics, begin to read Black women writers, to read Minjin Lee, Elizabeth Acevedo, and Jacqueline Woodson, among so many others. Who was your most memorable guest? I was so nervous before my interview with Anita Hill because I am so in awe of her. I felt so much emotion. I asked her how it felt at that moment when she gave that testimony. She had already cultivated so much agency as a young person to do what she did. She had a sureness of self. Fast forward 30 years to her beautiful book, Believing. To read about the life that she's constructed against all odds, and despite the fact that so many people did not wish her well, wow. Anita Hill is still helping us in such tremendous ways by giving us a blueprint. She paved the way for hashtag Me Too. Who else will you interview on the podcast? I spoke with Gabrielle Union. Not only is she a stunning celebrity, but she's a passionate woman with a clear vision of what she wants as a mother, as a changemaker, and she's a voracious reader. Also, Tayari Jones. She's my mentor and my guiding light. I give so much credit to her for encouraging me to grow well-read Black girl, to dream bigger. Can you talk about your upcoming memoir and learning to be vulnerable? I have been this facilitator, this midwife of sorts, whose goal is to birth other people's stories, to listen closely to them. That process has made a huge difference in my life. I noticed that when I was doing that, I had to take a step back and ask myself how I can really be honest in a way that isn't protecting myself or isn't giving a facade, but really showing my ugly parts, my painful parts, the things that keep me up at night, my anxieties. Because of my visibility, no one would ever guess that I struggle with anxiety. In the memoir, I'm trying to share all parts of myself and really be vulnerable. That honesty and vulnerability will help people feel okay about their insecurities, and it will also be part of my legacy. I want people to see that I had a full life and there were good things that happened that were so exhilarating and changed my life, but there were also challenging things that also made me who I am. My relationship with my mother is very complicated, but it's also the most beautiful part of who I am, and I'm excited to write about it. I want people to wrap themselves in my story and connect with me beyond social media. In writing the book, I'm also paying tribute to the writers who basically inspired a generation of young Black novelists. I'm thinking about Toni Cade Bambara, Maya Angelou, and Toni Morrison, among others, all the legends who continue to help so many Black women from the page. What is your favorite quote? "We are each other's magnitude and bond." Gwendolyn Brooks. Our next article by Mackenzie Jean Philippe, Hamilton Kane, and Jacinda Sanders is titled 21 Best Books by Black Authors You Should Read in Your Lifetime. You should always celebrate Black voices, not just during Black History Month. And literature is one of the best ways to honor some of the community's most illuminating stories. Thanks to the work of African American authors, the world can better understand both the struggles and triumphs of Black people in America. From wise artists like Maya Angelou to new voices like Honoré Fanon Jeffers and Ashley C. Ford, as well as leaders like the Obamas, we've gathered some of the all-time best books by Black authors to add to your reading list. Number 1, Recitative, A Story by Toni Morrison. First published in 1983, the Nobel laureate's only short story is a formal experiment that both stokes and defies our expectations, a chess game she's destined to win. As 8-year-olds, Twyla and Roberta are dumped for 4 months into a home for runaway and orphan girls. As Twyla notes, "My mother danced all night and Roberta's was sick." Within St. Bonaventure, they're hapless pawns near the bottom of the social pecking order, just above Maggie, the mute, disabled kitchen aid. But the literary queen has a gambit up her sleeve. One girl is white and the other Black, and Morrison jumbles their racial identities through a series of moves that undermine historical hierarchies and simple binaries. When the girls reunite as women, they seek out the truth about what exactly went down so many years earlier. Zadie Smith offers an incisive, surprising introduction, recognizing the burdens the author placed on herself and us all, stepping out of her comfort zone while tirelessly advocating for the African-American culture out of which and towards which Morrison writes. Number 2, Kindred by Octavia E. Butler. In what is considered a literary masterpiece and Butler's most popular novel, Kindred follows a young Black woman named Dana. Though she lives in 1976 LA, she's suddenly transported to a Civil War-era plantation in Maryland. Soon, the more frequently Dana travels back in time, the longer she stays, as she faces dangers that threaten her life in the future. Number 3, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings by Maya Angelou. Written by a legendary writer, civil rights activist, and one of Oprah's greatest friends, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings is a poetic memoir that captures Angelou's childhood struggles and the freedoms of her adulthood, which allowed her to find strength amid despair. Number 4, The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois by Honoré Fanon Jeffers. This powerful intergenerational debut novel and Oprah's book club pick explores the story and history of Black and Indigenous people in the South through the eyes of Ailey Pearl Garfield, the product of a small Georgia town and family lineage that tells the expansive, far-reaching story of Black America striving for dignity, respect, and freedom. Number 5, Sister Outsider by Audre Lorde. The celebrated collection of 15 essays and speeches by Audre Lorde, the famed activist, reflects on themes of ageism, racism, homophobia, and class. Number 6, Their Eyes Were Watching God by Zora Neale Hurston. Originally published in 1937 and set in southern Florida, this story follows main character Janie Crawford on her quest to find independence throughout 3 different marriages. Number 7, Go Tell It on the Mountain by James Baldwin. As one of our country's great Black writers, Baldwin published a slew of books, short stories, and essays in his lifetime. In his first book, Go Tell It on the Mountain, he penned a semi-autobiographical story of a teen growing up in 1930s Harlem who struggles with self-identity as the stepson of a strict Pentecostal minister. Similarly, Baldwin was raised by a stepfather who served as a Baptist pastor. Number 8, The Color Purple by Alice Walker. Adapted into a Steven Spielberg-directed film that earned Oprah an Oscar nomination, The Color Purple tells the tale of Celie, a young girl growing up in poverty in segregated Georgia. Despite suffering hardship, Celie finds her way back to the one she loves in a time-tested story. Number 9, Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison. Now thought of as an essential reading in American literature, this novel won the National Book Award for Fiction in 1953. The Invisible Man is narrated by a nameless main character who details growing up in a Black Southern community. He's eventually expelled from college and then becomes a leader of a Black nationalist group. Number 10, The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration by Isabel Wilkerson. Published in 2010 and winner of the Pulitzer Prize, Wilkerson's magisterial work charts the mass exodus of African Americans in the early 20th century from the Jim Crow South into northern and western cities, where they built successful lives amid racism etched in softer shades. With consummate skill, Wilkerson braids the stirring stories of her 3 guides, a pugilistic Floridian turned Harlem activist, a Mississippi sharecropper later rooted in Chicago, and Ray Charles's personal physician from Louisiana, into a classic of narrative nonfiction destined to influence writers for generations to come. Number 11, The 1619 Project, A New Origin Story by Nicole Hannah Jones. An expanded and largely reimagined version of the August 18, 2019 special issue of the New York Times Magazine, memorializing the year 4 centuries ago, when more than 20 enslaved Africans first arrived on the shores of England's American colonies. With new original material, contributors, and rebuttals to some of the controversy the issue engendered, this work offers a definitive account of how racism and Black resistance have shaped the U.S. to the present day. Number 12, Beloved by Toni Morrison. The Pulitzer Prize-winning novel is arguably Morrison's most well-known. It tells the story of Seth, a former slave who escaped to Ohio in the 1870s, but despite her freedom, finds herself haunted by the trauma of her past. In 1998, Oprah starred in the film adaptation. Number 13, We Should All Be Feminists by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. Adapted from her TEDx talk of the same name, Adichie uses personal experiences and understanding of sexual politics to define what feminism means in the 21st century. Number 14, A Raisin in the Sun by Lorraine Hansberry. A Raisin in the Sun chronicles the lives of a Southside Chicago family as they dream of life's possibilities after their matriarch, Lena, gets a substantial insurance check. The dramatic play originally opened on Broadway in 1959, with a recent revival in 2014 starring Denzel Washington. Number 15, Becoming by Michelle Obama. Officially the best-selling book of 2018, the former First Lady tells all in what Oprah called a vulnerable memoir, in which she opens up about her marriage and life before and after the White House. Number 16, The Sweetness of Water by Nathan Harris. The Civil War is winding down and President Lincoln has issued the Emancipation Proclamation, which means enslaved brothers Landry and Prentice can at last leave the plantation on which they've spent their lives. And yet danger lurks everywhere around them in Confederate Georgia, even after they are given shelter and employment by an eccentric white couple from the North. The stunning debut novel probes the limits of freedom in a society where ingrained prejudice and inequality remain the law of the land. Number 17, Dreams from My Father by Barack Obama. And now, the second Obama on this list. In his own best-selling memoir, Number 44 unloads the difficulties of being a biracial American, emphasized by the estranged relationship he had with his late father. Number 18, South to America, A Journey Below the Mason-Dixon to Understand the Soul of a Nation by Amani Perry. From the best-selling author and Princeton professor comes a personal and historical reflection on the centrality of the American South's narratives to our nation's identity and history. From popular dollar store chains to the relatives of some of the United States' most significant black activists and historians, the South is home to more than just the stain of slavery. It is a focal point of much of our past because it has much to tell us about our present and our future. Number 19, Moon Witch, Spider King by Marlon James. From Anthony Doerr's Cloud Cuckoo Land to Hanya Yanagihara's To Paradise, world-building is a literary technique du jour, but few authors have had the commercial success of Marlon James, whose Black Leopard, Red Wolf blew up bestseller lists from coast to coast. His epic second installment in the Dark Stars trilogy, billed as an African Game of Thrones, turns on the foibles of Sogalan, a witch-cum-player in the royal court of James' supernova imagination. His ambition and storytelling prowess are off the charts. Number 20, Somebody's Daughter, A Memoir by Ashley C. Ford. This New York Times bestseller from writer and podcaster Ashley C. Ford centers on her coming-of-age story in Indiana and her difficulty of growing up with a father in prison, though it takes many years before she discovers why he is there. Number 21, Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates. A 2015 winner of the National Book Award for Nonfiction, the renowned journalist and writer pens a profound letter to his son about what it means to be black in America in the 21st century, a place in which you struggle to overcome the historical trauma of your people while trying to find your own purpose in the world. Our next article by Cassie Hurwitz is titled Bridget Floyd on Keeping Her Brother George's Memory Alive. It has been more than 2 years since the murder of George Floyd, which sent a shockwave through the world and reinforced a fact that many black Americans and others already knew to be true. Racism is still one of the biggest issues plaguing our country. This past May, almost 2 years to the day George Floyd was killed, a gunman opened fire in a black-owned grocery store in a majority black area of Buffalo, New York, one of the most segregated cities in the country. He murdered 10 people in what was widely considered a race-driven crime. Racist attacks on people in the AAPI community are rampant, too, from individual assaults to the 2021 Atlanta shooting. Although it may seem like nothing has changed in the months since George Floyd's death, his sister, Bridget Floyd, is working tirelessly to keep his memory alive and to fight for racial justice. "I feel like my brother sacrificed his life for the world," Floyd tells Oprah Daily. "I didn't get all the time I think I needed with my brother, but all the time that we did share was very special. Our bond was very different. It was just different." One way Floyd is celebrating that relationship is through a short film, The Gentle Giant, which is part of the Ad Council's Love Has No Labels campaign. The specific project, titled Love Lives On, highlights her story along with that of Maddie Park, a young woman who crowdfunded cab rides to get elderly and LGBTQ plus in the AAPI community home safe, and Barbara Poma, the owner of the Pulse nightclub, who established a nonprofit for the victims and survivors of the 2016 shooting that occurred there. The title of Love Lives On went hand in hand with what I'm out here doing for my brother, keeping his name alive, Floyd says. The George Floyd Memorial Foundation is to honor my brother's legacy by uniting and activating our communities. The short film, which is currently streaming on YouTube and Hulu, is designed to promote equity and inclusivity. In the film, helmed by up-and-coming Chicago-based director Andre Muir, actors recreate some of the happy moments the Floyd siblings shared when George was alive, like the two of them dancing to MC Light's Poor Georgie, and George meeting Bridget's boyfriend. It was very emotional, Floyd says, of being on set. Although it was heart-wrenching, Floyd also felt relief while working on The Gentle Giant. I would say it was kind of therapeutic, she says. It just took a little emotional toll off for me. Partly the lightening of that burden is knowing that the responsibility of fighting for racial justice is a group effort. I hope that this story will inspire and empower others to join the fight for justice and take meaningful action in different communities, Floyd says. She sees the short film as a jumping-off point for people to learn about bias and discrimination, too, if they don't know where to begin. Sometimes I get discouraged because I feel like maybe we're not being heard, she says. Then The Gentle Giant was released in July 2022. Derek Chauvin, the former police officer who was convicted of murdering Floyd, had just been sentenced to 21 years in prison. I don't understand why police officers cannot be treated like regular humans, Floyd remarks, adding that cops are protected so much when they're supposed to be protecting us. A crime is a crime. It doesn't matter who you are, what color your skin is, what you did. She also can't help thinking that if the roles had been reversed, there would have been a different outcome. What if the shoe had been on the other foot and Floyd would have had his knee on Derek's neck? I'm sure, I am most certainly sure, he would have definitely got more time than Derek Chauvin did. Still, she concedes, no matter how long the sentence, it could never make up for her family's loss. The time could never replace Floyd. He's gone, she says. Floyd takes solace in the fact that her family, particularly through the work of the foundation, is helping to keep the issue of police brutality in people's minds. I'm glad that this wasn't one of those situations where it just was swept under the rug, she says of Chauvin's sentence. When it comes to moving forward, she's instead choosing to focus on two things, love and action. For her, love is more than just words. It's about showing up and proving it. I want people across the world to realize the impact of one simple act of love and what that can mean for communities facing discrimination, she says. Everyone should do their part and take meaningful action that creates more of an accepting and inclusive world across race, gender, religion, disability. The Gentle Giant ends on the hopeful idea that with one love-driven action at a time, we can move the needle. The Ad Council provides ideas for viewers who are inspired to get started solving this crisis on their Love Has No Labels page. All I can do is do my part, says Floyd. Hopefully people will see the change. You can watch The Gentle Giant on YouTube or Hulu and visit the Love Has No Labels campaign page to show love through action. Our next article by Joelle Speranza is titled, How to Keep It Together in Front of Your Kids. While I watched my 7-year-old daughter and 5-year-old son play catch with their friends as we were camped out on a crowded field in town, waiting for the 4th of July fireworks to begin, I couldn't help but think, I hope we are safe here. While the children were oblivious to the news of the Highland Park parade shooting earlier that day, where 8 were killed and 29 were injured, it was top of my mind. The victims and other people in attendance included parents with young kids just like our family, people who were excited to celebrate a long weekend, unplug from the stress of the week and world, and just enjoy the moment. But those moments at the parade turned into their last as they scrambled to protect their children and their own lives. I wondered if there was a mass shooting situation during our town's fireworks, would we even hear it over the explosions in the sky? It was dark outside, which way would we run? Which of my 2 kids would flee with me, and who would my husband grab? As tragedies in the news continue to pile on top of each other, moments that we used to take for granted as parents, like simply hanging out with our kids, are being interrupted by anxious thoughts about our safety, which experts I spoke with say is a totally natural and understandable response. Whenever tragedy hits, our empathetic system kicks into gear, and we automatically play and replay what it must have been like for those who underwent the tear, says Michelle Kambolis, a mind-body health specialist, registered therapist, meditation teacher, and author of When Women Rise, Everyday Practices to Strengthen Your Mind, Body, and Soul. Our minds ruminate and review the scenes of the event because we're trying to process the unimaginable. And as a parent, we can't help but worry about our own child's safety and uncertainty of the world they are living in. For those with very young children, born right before or during the pandemic and onslaught of current social and political issues, the anxious loop of worry that becoming a parent can bring on or ratchet up is all we know. No matter how old your kids are, the current cycle of bad news, tension, and anxiety piled on top of whatever else is going on in your life means suiting up daily for another round of mental and emotional Olympics. We're coaching our families and steeling ourselves to keep it together in front of our kids, maintain healthy home environments, work, and do our best to preserve the innocence of childhood. To parent effectively during these times and protect your own well-being, you need a game plan. Until now, my go-to play has been the fake-out, steeling myself to hold it together and appear like everything is normal until my kids are well out of sight. I first heard about the mass shooting at Robb Elementary when I checked my phone during my daughter's softball game, but I had to quickly bury my emotions, tap open my camera app, and photograph my girl at bat. The next morning on the ride to school, I recalled with angst her telling me that during a recent lockdown drill, she was in the bathroom and ran down the hallway to her classroom instead of hiding in a stall as instructed. Instead of cluing her into how I was feeling, I kissed her goodbye a few times for good measure, wished her a great day, and told her our special phrase, "My heart is in your heart." I lowered the music and watched as she walked past extra cops on her way into the building, far from my protection. Driving away, I unleashed tears, smearing mascara across my face. As a general rule, it is best to take time to process and regulate your own emotions surrounding upsetting events before sharing this information with your child, says Monica Vermani, clinical psychologist and author of A Deeper Wellness, Conquering Stress, Mood, Anxiety, and Traumas. But eventually, talking to our kids about how we're feeling is an important next step. Our children watch us, and they know when we're upset, distracted, stressed, or worried, says Vermani. It is important to be open and honest with our children and share age-appropriate information about whatever we may be upset with, agrees Andrea Dorn, psychotherapist and author of When Someone Dies, A Children's Mindful How-To Guide on Grief and Loss. When speaking to your kids, Kambolis advises parents to model mindfulness of emotion by naming it as compassionately as they can. You might let your child know, "I'm noticing that my mind is really racing today. Do you ever notice that in yourself?" Or, "My heart is really beating fast. Sometimes the body thinks it's in danger when it's not. I think I'll just pause and take a few deep breaths. You can join me if you need that too." Still, while healthy expression of emotions and coping strategies are important for our children to see, life goes on and there are times where we have to push through and push on, says Dorn. As a parent, this can feel incredibly difficult and energy depleting. We each have to find coping skills that work best. Though it's been hard for me to move past my anxiety after Robb Elementary, I have been trying to become more adventurous, taking our kids to public places with lots of people, like Liberty Science Center and even the fireworks. I want them to have fun experiences and not let my fears dictate what we do. How do I balance letting my guard down while we're out with the vigilance my mind requires, because my fears are valid, our world is a mess, without channeling that emotional hurricane to my kids? Dorn advises grounding yourself in the moment. One way to do that is through square breathing. Inhale for 4 counts, hold for 4 counts, exhale for 4 counts, hold for 4 counts, and repeat. Do this 5 to 10 times, explains Dorn. Although many may have heard this before, few of us actually do it. She also notes that whenever the time isn't right to process your feelings, you can try to focus on distractions like work, cleaning, playing with your kids, moving your body, or reading until you come back to process. Another tactic is to avoid negative stimuli, including overexposure to the endless cycle of media attention on distressing events, says Vermani. Kambolis agrees, adding, "The more we witness the sights and sounds of tragedy, the more it is wiring and rewiring into our neurobiological system. Instead, come into the moment and focus on what's happening right here, right now. By focusing on the sensation of the ground beneath you, the sounds in the room, or the taste of the cup of tea you're sipping, you can teach the mind to hold both the tragedy and the beauty that still exists. Keeping things in perspective and replacing negative thoughts with positive ones are other strategies suggested by Vermani. Challenge catastrophizing thoughts with realistic thoughts that are supported by facts rather than fueling worries and what-if statements. Remind yourself that life only comes with what you can handle, and we are all in this together. Managing and trusting, we can move on to the next moment. To get to that next moment, Campbell says, when times are difficult, there's one question that can cut right through the panic and grief and bring you home to your own healing. That question is, how can I be kind to myself right now? In the big picture, all experts point to self-care being of utmost importance and want you to recognize when you need support. Vermani stresses, establish a relationship with a mental health professional who you can call upon to help bring in perspective or give you coping skills in times of high stress, depression, and anxiety. I coincidentally had an introductory virtual appointment with a licensed professional counselor a couple of days after the tragedy. I told her that I was reaching out because I want to be the best version of myself for myself and my kids. Learning tools to manage anxiety helped me in the past, and I want to continue my self-improvement journey. I want to be able to give my children those tools to carry on through tough times and the courage to reach out when they need help. I also want them to know that wherever we are in this universe, we will always be one. Our cherished mantra is, "My heart is in your heart." So they know when things seem like they are falling apart, our hearts are always intertwined with love and beating together. Our next article by Michael Shaikh is titled, "Kosher Soul is Michael Twitty's Tribute to His Own Braided Identity." In The Cooking Gene, his award-winning first book, Michael Twitty, the celebrated culinary historian, embrace the discomfort of the South's racialized past to broaden our understanding of African-American culinary identities. Now he's turning his attention to Jewish cooking. His new book, Kosher Soul, The Faith and Food Journey of an African-American Jew, welcomes us into a conversation between two parts of his identity, Black and Jewish, to explore the marriage of these distinct cultures through the marriage of their distinct food traditions. Part biography and part memoir, Kosher Soul is at its heart an acknowledgement of the lives and culinary contributions of Jews of color, whose identity and legitimacy is questioned as much as it is ignored. Like The Cooking Gene, Kosher Soul is also intensely personal. Twitty uses food as his primary lens to navigate both his citizenship within Jewish community and his birthright as a Black man in America. Yet he also graciously makes room at the table for others, many more in fact, as he journeys into what it means to be a person with multiple families. To do this, Twitty has generously seasoned Kosher Soul with mesa, a Yiddish word meaning anecdote or tale. Mesa comes in many forms throughout the book: conversations, letters, prayers, intimate personal stories, recipes, but all are crucial to the essence of both Kosher Soul and Kosher Soul cooking, which are as much about resisting cultural erasure as they are about redefining our narrow concept of family. I first met Michael Twitty several years ago in Harlem after listening to him speak with the gifted chef and culinary historian Therese Nelson at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture. Listening to their conversation that hot summer afternoon about the culinary consequences of slavery inspired me, even setting me on my own book path exploring how the violence I have witnessed working in war zones changes food cultures. I spoke with Michael about his new book about popular misconceptions of Jews of color and how you don't have to be Black or Jewish to love kosher soul food. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
Good, and I'm thankful for the work that you've done. So maybe you can start by telling us, what's the connection between The Cooking Gene and Kosher Soul? The Cooking Gene and Kosher Soul are parts of a tripartite trio of books that talk about identity. It's interesting how Kosher Soul is already about being at sort of the crossroads to so many different things. So my third project would be about gay identity in food and cooking. What does the phrase Kosher Soul mean? Who is it for, and what do you want your readers to walk away with? It's the food of Black women who cooked for Ashkenazi Jewish households in the Deep South.
It's the food of African American Jewish communities historically. It's the food of people who come in, who are brand new, who are now blending these very global approaches to African diaspora, African Atlantic, and Jewish diaspora, Jewish food. It's fusion. It's not fusion, it's inclusion. It's exclusion. It's all of those things. And it's the history of the people who make that food and what they bring to this nexus of Black Jewish engagement in North America in particular. Are you saying that it is hard to identify this group clearly, or that people have a limited idea of Jewish identity? Since World War II, people, especially in the U.S., have had a really hard time understanding and seeing Jews as anything but white in the American sense, people who were exiled and expelled during the Reign of Terror against Jews in Europe. However, the antiquity of the Jewish people has us born where Southwest Asia meets Northeastern Africa. Moshe Rabbeinu, the figure most people refer to as Moses, the biggest prophet in Judaism and teacher in Judaism of the law, was born in Africa. When we come out of Africa during the Exodus, we're known as an Erev Rav, which means a mixed multitude. E pluribus unum. It's very chiaroscuro. We may come in lots of colors, but we carry all of these roots and narratives. Can you say more about people's expectations for what being Jewish looks like, or what Black belief and religion is supposed to look like? If you're of African descent, you encounter assumptions. Somehow being Black and Muslim and Black and Christian is absolutely normal, but being Black and Jewish is weird or problematic, or people say, that's a choice. People see me and say, that can't be right. If you took a lot of people from the European Jewish diaspora back in time to visit their ancestors living in Iraq and Iran, in ancient Israel, Palestine, and other places, they wouldn't know what to do with them. There's a moment in the Torah when Jacob blesses his grandchildren through Joseph. They have been raised Egyptian. They're running around with cornrows. Jacob sees this and puts his hand on their head to bless them, and he's like, "Who are you?" Can you speak about the population of Black Jews in America? How big is the community? We have between 50,000 and 100,000 people who, are they Black? Are they Jewish? Are they halakhically Jewish, meaning Jewish by virtue of practicing the laws and tenets, or because their mother was Jewish? When it comes to Blackness, it has been way too easy to just be like, well, I guess I'm just Black. Because one drop rule, Black. It's are you on the white team or the Black team? To answer your question, it's hard to tell you distinct numbers because we've only really begun to have synthesis among the Jewish community to actually talk about who is defined as African American or not. Can you talk about the letter in Kosher Soul to your former students about being Jewish and LGBTQ+, and perhaps how that might help others navigate their complex identity in these times? The letter to my students is all about, from me, saying to them that I've been there. Other people will be where they're going and have been, and that it's a cycle. And uniquely in Judaism and Jewish peoplehood, it's important that they find their place. We use the euphemism makom in Hebrew. It means place, but also means the presence of God. I wanted my students and others to really find their places. I've found my place, and it's not a linear journey. None of it is. It's very difficult. Every day in different circles, people express identities that are specific to them in colorful ways, using the tools of the world around them, and they're trying to communicate something about themselves and the human condition. About the recipes in the book, it may seem odd to see macaroni salad and southern fried chicken and collards alongside latkes and kugel. Can you tell me how these seemingly different culinary traditions can be part of the same family of traditions? I also wanted to show people that if you were Jewish in the Deep South, none of that would be uncommon. I have menus reflecting all parts of the African Atlantic, but also reflecting different regions within Jewish culture and different styles and influences of cooking. All of that's in there. Some of these recipes are no longer made. What does that feel like to make something out of history, to really be able to taste something that has this long historical tale? It's being electric and wooden at the same time. It is both the best of resurrection and the awareness that, okay, this is wood. It's both alive and dead. We bring them back to life as we can, and there is, for me, a certain pleasure in creating and bringing recipes back as they're written down and saying, okay, that's really cool. I'm learning something from this. And talking to the recipe author, if there was one, and saying, I'm learning from you. It's all just the thrill of making sure that the tradition does not die with you, and it's also having another rung of experience and skill behind you that you can therefore build on to make something new. So to be old, to be now, to be new. We'll end this week with a message from Oprah. It's been a beautiful summer, and it is officially ending for a lot of people. I want to tell you that one of the things that's been the joys of summer for me is actually this uniform. A white t-shirt, my leggings that I've actually worn a hole in walking this summer, and my backpack. Thank you, Rita Wilson. She gave me this backpack for my birthday. I've been hiking practically every day since. Even when I was in Nashville with my father in June, when it was so hot you had to get up before the sun came up in order to get your walking in, I still walked. I've been hiking every day, literally hiking my butt off, is what ended up happening, and here's one of the things I learned. It's a great metaphor for life, this hiking, is that when you have the steepest hill on the mountain, you don't look at the mountain or what's ahead, you just concentrate on one foot in front of the other, one foot in front of the other. And when you really want to make yourself feel good about where you're going, look at how far you've come and not how far you have to go. Look, even now you can see all the clouds moving in. I love it when that happens. You know why? Because when the clouds move in, you can't even see how far you have to go. You just put one foot in front of the other, one foot in front of the other. The clouds move in, and they always also move out. So whatever cloud you're facing right now in your life, it's already on its way to moving out. Just put one foot in front of the other. And when you really want to make yourself feel good about where you're going, look at how far you've come and not how far you have to go. Look, even now you can see all the clouds moving in. I love it when that happens. You know why? Because when the clouds move in, you can't even see how far you have to go. You just put one foot in front of the other, one foot in front of the other. The clouds move in, and they always also move out. So whatever cloud you're facing right now in your life, it's already on its way to moving out. Just put one foot in front of the other. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.